In the early 1960s, Bernard Stillman started the iconoclastic music label ESP Disc, and over the next decade he released records by Albert Eiler, who we are listening to, Sun Ra, Pharoah Saunders, Ornette Coleman, Timothy Leary, The Fugs, and even Charles Manson. Then, in the mid-1970s, Mr. Stillman shut the label down abruptly, and there were even rumors that he was dead. Actually, he was just taking a long break from the music business. But now Bernard Stillman has brought ESP Disc back to life, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the show. Hello.
Hello.
So how did a single, small, one-man label like ESP come to record so many people who we now remember as being key figures of the 60s?
I fell into it, actually. I was a music lawyer, and some of my clients at the beginning of my career were jazz musicians. They call it jazz. We don't call it jazz. We call it improvisation, free improvisation. And I recognized that there was an entire community out there who were totally desperate. The music had changed. Bebop had given way to John Coltrane and Miles and Diz. And another community had arisen, a later generation. They had nowhere to go. They were mature. They were ready to be heard. But the major labels kept their doors closed on them.
Well, not all of them. Ornette Coleman had sold a lot of records for Atlantic Records.
Ornette was a notable exception. But by and large, the major companies were fearful about trying to introduce anything that was not already widely known. They weren't going to spend the money and effort to introduce an art form that had changed significantly. Someone had to do it.
Well, it's understandable that the majors wouldn't want to put out a record that might sell 5,000 records at best.
Well, someone had to put records out without reference to the bottom line. I had a career as a lawyer, music career. I was supporting myself. I discovered that I loved the music, and I felt there was a need for someone to take care of it. So I elected myself to become the, if you will, the chronicler of what was going on.
Small labels have all sorts of problems that the big labels don't have, like distribution, don't they? I remember when I was in the record business, one of the big issues was getting paid. And the big labels could say, well, if you want the next Bob Dylan record, you better pay me for that Janis Joplin record, and the money would come.
This was a very hazardous, hair-raising, irrational, if you will, impractical undertaking. However, the nature of the industry was such that millions of dollars had been invested in machinery, and a pressing plant would press 500 records for you if you wished, because they were so thoroughly automated. And they weren't expensive. The distributors would take them on consignment. They wouldn't pay for them unless they sold them. They took no risk whatsoever.
But it was you who had to get paid for it.
We took all the risk, yes, and so it was very chancy. However, from the very inception, Albert Eiler, these various artists, we released 12 titles at the inception. Critics were flabbergasted. They decided, well, this is not a vanity label. This guy must be serious. They did their calculations, figured out how much it must have cost to put out 12 records. And they took it seriously. And
we also had some of the most famous avant-garde musicians of the time. Sun Ra was established at that point. Milford Graves was known. Sonny Murray was known. Frank Wright. These were not obscure musicians.
They weren't obscure to the jazz community, but the public at large and the record stores, the whole apparatus, was not really interested in breaking new ground.
How many records could you sell by those artists?
We were lucky to sell 500.
You were. Was that your first run?
A few titles reordered. Albert Eiler's Spiritual Unity certainly reordered. Bells. Some of our records reordered. But it wasn't a livelihood. I mean, I had to have a staff overhead. And it wasn't really very profitable. And I really despaired from the beginning, almost from the beginning. And then someone came to me and he said, why do you look so down? I said, we're in big trouble. I said, the records aren't selling. We're not being noticed. We have an overhead. I think I'm going to lose this. He said, you have no problem. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you've got the Fugs.
Yes, you had the Fugs.
And I said, we do? Yes. He said, they want to record for ESP.
So you had the Fugs, and you also had William Burroughs, Timothy Leary. Did those records sell better?
They didn't sell at all. In this apparatus, in this system, with our very limited ability to publicize anything, we spent almost no money on press or media. Critics were wonderful to us, but we didn't advertise. We didn't have the funds for it. So it was really a very impractical, very not very solid operation.
On the other hand, you were producing records that had historic significance, and I would assume that if you could warehouse them long enough, you'd sell them all anyway.
That's absolutely true. And as we had, we had a three-year life, 65 to 68. In 68, we had three records on the charts, pop charts. It was
the Fugs and what else?
The Fugs and the Pearls Before Swine, Tom Rapp. We were, the place had taken fire. We were doing wonderfully. And I was beginning to pay my bills and look forward to success. One small problem. Each group had a song that stung the government. Tom Rapp, Pearls Before Swine, had a song called Uncle John, which accused Lyndon Johnson of being a war profiteer. Well, I don't think this set very well with Mr. Johnson, who was notoriously thin-skinned. And the lyrics were brilliant, I thought. And so overnight, we were shut down. Now,
what, the government came in and shut down your operation?
They're much too subtle for that. What happened was a pressing plant that we'd been using went into business on our product overnight. They must have gotten some kind of support and approval. And suddenly our business dropped to zero. There were no longer any phone calls. The shippers did not order. In the middle of this success, with three top albums soaring to the top of the charts, we were number 30 on the pop charts on one of our records. So overnight, we were out of business.
You also released a record by Charles Manson. How did that happen? I know that one of his songs had been recorded by the Beach Boys called Cease to Resist, although I think Dennis Wilson got the writing credit on that. And he was very angry, and I hear he sent a bullet to Dennis Wilson as a way of telling him that he shouldn't have done that. What happened with you?
Well,
did you realize this was a dangerous guy to deal with?
Between 68 and 74, the year I officially closed the founding operation, I had lost my staff. I mean, I'd given up my staff. There were was no distribution. I went right on producing records, which was kind of a little bit nuts. I mean, for 6 years, I produced records, but they went nowhere. They could go nowhere because I'd been demolished. Our company had been demolished. But in 72, I think, or 73, I learned about the Manson album. By then, he was already convicted and in prison. And the man who produced the Manson record, Manson produced it himself, but the man whom he had given to it to after he went to prison, Phil Kaufman, was a road manager for a number of famous artists, Etta James, Emmylou Harris. And I read about the album being in circulation, and I contacted him. He was on the West Coast. And he said, I don't want that album. He said, my house was surrounded by men and women with knives, and they're threatening me, and they want money to help Charles. And he said, I can't take any more of this. I said, send it to me. So we came east with a few hundred records, and we made an agreement, and I put the record out. Well, it was meaningless because I didn't have distribution. They were shipped to distributors, and distributors didn't return any of them, but they refused to take any more. The dealers were so enraged at this whole thing. So the year was 73, 74. That was just before I closed the doors finally. So the record has no longevity, but clearly it was a hot potato. It was a live one, as it were.
My guess is Bernard Stolman, who ran the label ESP Disc for a number of years and then shut it down and has just recently revived it. Are you including all of the old records in your new stock, reissuing them on CD?
As rapidly as we can, yes.
Meanwhile, we were talking about some of the people that you recorded. You tried to record Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin.
Well, I didn't try to record Janis Joplin. I would have liked to. I didn't know it, but in a book that was published about her life, a letter was reproduced, and she had written to her mother or her sister saying she's coming to New York to record for ESP Disc.
Because that was a label that she probably bought
identified with, yes. Mm-hmm. And at one point, at the Village Second Avenue Theater, there was a benefit of some kind. Tom Rapp performed there, and she was to perform, and I showed up there. And it was quiet. It was well in advance of the concert. It was empty, and she was sitting on the stairway inside, sulking.
This is before Big Brother's success?
Yes. Mm-hmm. She had just come to New York, and I didn't know about her interest in ESP. I knew who she was, of course. And I stood there with her alone, just us in the theater, and she sat there and growled because the Big Brother group had not shown up yet for the sound check, I guess. She was very angry about that. And alas, we never really exchanged identifications.
Now, that would have really changed things. You probably wouldn't have given up the label. So what did you do when you just shut down and people wondered where the heck Bernard Stolman was?
I assume so. I had lost my staff, and I really did not maintain communication with the industry.
Did you hear the rumors that you were dead?
Yes, I heard the rumors many, many years later. Actually, I eventually became an assistant attorney general of the state of New York, a conventional law job, went to work every day with a suit on, and hid from the record world, hid from my musicians. I didn't go to record stores or concerts. I felt I'd failed them. I was very, very upset and very sad, and I felt that I had not kept my commitment to them.
Well, there was a certain amount of anger toward you as well. In her History of Free Jazz, Valerie Wilmer called you the most hated and most needed man in jazz history. What did you do to deserve that?
I think, it didn't have anything to do, whatever it was about, it wasn't about my practices regarding the creation of the records, because I gave the artists total authority to do whatever they saw fit. I kept out of their way. There were no producers on these records. My name didn't appear on any of them. I wanted them to have the freedom that I think any artist should have, an original artist should have, innovative artist, to do their own thing. This was not the pattern in the industry, obviously. The major labels had producers, had elaborate systems with studios and overhead and budgets, and the artists were pretty much told what they would do because they wanted these records to sell. They wanted them to be commercial. I had no such criteria and no such requirements because, to me, this is all art. An art form, and art does not take well to dictation. So I felt the artist should have the freedom, the anarchy, if you will, to do what they should have been doing.
I'm sure they thought, I'm selling records and this guy's not giving me any money.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely true. But what they didn't appreciate, I think, is that it takes an apparatus, it takes investment to promote a record properly and to get sales. And I was working upstream. It was uphill all the way.
Is this a good time to be getting into the record business? A lot of record labels are complaining that they have to struggle to make it. There are all the changes in technology over the 30 years that you've been out of the business. Many people listen online. They download MP3s. They listen on their iPods. And CD sales are down.
Our sales are up precipitously. Because our audience is not that general mainstream that is downloading. Our people, I found, want physical product. They're not really interested in streaming.
So you have actually gone to pre-avant-garde jazz. In fact, one of your releases, which has gotten incredibly great reviews, is Billie Holiday's Rare Live Recordings from 1935 to 1959. How did you gain access to those?
My first job as a lawyer was in the office of a maverick lawyer named Flo Kennedy. She was the lawyer for the estates of Billie Holiday and Charlie Parker. So I met Louis McKay, Billie's widower, and it must seem strange to you, but I wasn't aware of either artist at the time. My knowledge of jazz was very...
You knew Albert Isla, but not Billie Holiday.
Yes.
Not Charlie Parker.
No, not Charlie Parker, no. And so I became aware of both of these artists and how extraordinary they were. And as my impulse grew to start a label, I thought that Billie was absolutely magnificent, and I was able to pick up some material, live broadcasts, and I put them out.
And I don't think many of these have ever been available, or not for a long time.
Not officially available. On all sorts of little bootleg labels, I think. They were broadcasts. They were of terrible technical quality. They hadn't been filtered. We didn't have the means then to convert them to listenable versions.
I'm sure most people think that ESP refers to extrasensory perception, but it really is the first three letters of Esperanto, isn't it?
Yes, it didn't begin with the idea of ESP. I had started my first experiment in records was Let's Sing in Esperanto, an LP that I released in 63 of songs and poetry, you know, poetry and in the international language. And that is what made me aware of the availability, the readily accessibility of all this machinery to put out a record with not a great expense. Not a great expense.
Of course, music is also an international language. I would have assumed that you would have achieved a certain amount of sales abroad because jazz has a whole different kind of audience in Japan and in Europe than it does in this country.
The initial records that we sold, or those we pressed, went to Europe and Japan. In the U.S., there were almost no sales at all.
And now, do you find that those artists who are part of the history of jazz, major figures in the history of jazz, that there's a demand for those records?
They're selling well, and they're selling far better in this country than they had 40 years ago.
Now, we're going to go out with some music from one of your more recent ESP disc releases, Huguenot. What is? Can you tell us about this group in 10 seconds?
I can only tell you that the general manager of the label is a bass player who plays a great variety of instruments, and he brought me his group, one of his groups, a trio, and it's very free and very improvisational, and I think it's quite beautiful.
And is this jazz?
You could call it jazz if you insist. I think it's simply free form. It's just modern music.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Bernard Stolman, who has revived his legendary label, ESP Disc.